dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And who better to ask about matters involving, well, intelligence, among other things, than a man who has devoted most of his professional life and a very distinguished public career at that to the intelligence collection and analysis on the part of the United States government to protect all of us. He is, of course, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, Fred Flights. You may know him for his service at the Central Intelligence Agency for about 20 years as the Chief of Staff to John Bolton in the Department of State and as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author of Obama Bomb, a great growing national security fraud. Fred Flights, it is so good to have you with us. I appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, Frank.
I want to start with a story that bears on intelligence, for sure, and also the compromise thereof, namely the leaks that have been taking place, some of which involve the unmasking of some of the people who have been caught up, presumably unintentionally, in surveillance. Among them, the former director of the National Defense Intelligence Agency, also for a time the National Security Advisor to the President, Lieutenant General Mike Flynn. Give us the latest on this, in particular the piece involving Susan Rice and what she seems to have done, Fred, that I find very distressing.
Well, it appears that Susan Rice, who previously said that she did not ask for unmasking, and that is to release the names of Americans inadvertently caught up in intelligence collection, usually NSA collection. This information is supposed to be masked to protect the privacy of American citizens. They're not supposed to be collected by foreign intelligence agencies. Rice first said she didn't.
You mean intelligence agency of the United States that are supposed to focus on foreign?
That is U.S. Intelligence agencies that collect foreign intelligence. She first said she didn't ask for this, and then she said she did, but for legitimate reasons. But now we found out that the records on her unmasking requests have been sent to the Obama Presidential Library, where they reportedly will not be accessible for 5 years. I actually think they are accessible if President Trump asks for them. But the question here is, what is Rice trying to hide? If she did nothing wrong, why wouldn't she and former President Obama say, sure, take a look at the records? There's obviously something that they don't want people to know.
It sounds a bit like obstruction of justice to me, at the very least impeding justice. And I think, at least according to Andy McCarthy, in addition to the president extricating those documents from a library that doesn't exist, we should remember, I gather Congress or the special counsel could also countermand this effort by her to stash her stuff, as they say. Fred, she's also, Susan Rice is, that is, sort of hinting that she thinks there's some sexism or racism or both at work in the vilifying she's come in for, both in this connection, this unmasking business, and also Benghazi. Do you credit that, or knowing what you do about these cases, is there plenty to be critical of?
I don't. It's just so ridiculous. It's a shame that she's stooping to playing the race card. Clearly, she asked for the names of Trump campaign and Trump transition officials to be unmasked. And the fact that she asked for multiple people, it's hard to explain that this could be for legitimate national security reasons. It has nothing to do with racism. It has nothing to do with sexism. It has to do with someone abusing her authority in the Obama administration. That's it.
Yeah. And I would argue that's exactly what she did in the Benghazi caper, of course, where she was sent flocking the idea that this was a video that precipitated that murderous rampage on the part of identified jihadists, something that was known to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and others at the very moment she was out telling the rest of us a very different story. Let me just ask you more generally, Fred, you've been giving some considerable thought to what Obama holdovers inside the Trump administration are up to that may be contributing to the kind of problems that this administration is running into at the moment.
Well, I have been thinking about this, and I believe that President Obama has to stay publicly on the record to his staff to stop leaking to the press, stop leaking intelligence to the press. And I'm talking about former Obama staffers and people who the Obama administration promoted into sensitive positions in government. You know, the Obama administration brought these people into government in most cases and vetted them for high-level clearances or chose careerists for sensitive positions. And that means Mr. Obama bears responsibility for these leaks. And so, look, we frankly know, I don't think there's any doubt, that senior Obama aides know who these leakers are, and they're probably orchestrating them. This is now Obama's legacy, this legacy of leaks. And you know, Frank, there are people on the right who believe that Democrats cannot be trusted with national security. I think that's really an unfair charge. But based on this, I think this charge is becoming true. And when we have Democrats running for office in the future, I think the American people are going to have to consider that when the Obama team left office, they did not honor their security agreements. They could not be trusted with national security.
Well, and among them, I'm afraid, may well be the former president of the United States, because, as you know very well, Fred Feitz, he is actively operating against the Trump administration, I think in basically an unprecedented way, certainly in modern memory. Hey, Fred, very quickly, there is an imminent decision, we're told, on Iran policy. And I gather that the administration has been taking counsel from lots of people. I know you've been talked to at various points. What do you think are the chances that there will be a significant departure from what you've written about in Obama Bomb was a national security fraud and really a malfeasant policy with respect to one of the most dangerous regimes on the planet? And specifically that changing that regime may be a part of the new policy.
I think long term, the only solution to this problem is regime change. But I'm worried. I'm worried because there are people in this administration who want to stick with the terrible Iran deal negotiated by the Obama administration. Now, they won the first round when in April, the administration declared that Iran is in compliance with the agreement and that the agreement is in the interest of the United States, which I just think was outrageous. And it went against the advice of some pretty good people, pretty knowledgeable experts. But frankly, I think the swamp of the State Department won. And there are certain career officers certain political appointees in this administration who didn't stand up to them. I'm hoping we'll have a better outcome this time, but I'm worried.
Speaking of the State Department, Fred, let me just ask you really pointedly. You spent some time in the senior reaches of that organization. There is now apparently a very public rift between the president's senior staff in the White House and Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, over who will be appointing people to positions in the Department of State, political appointee positions, including, I guess, ambassadors. What do you make of what's going on here?
It really puzzles me that there are people at the Pentagon and the State Department who want to bring in never-Trumpers and Democrats. That's what's going on at State. Why Tillerson's doing this and his staff is doing this, I don't know. But I understand that the White House is resisting it. I'm just flabbergasted, and I'm just wondering sometimes who won the election and why isn't the government staff? The president can't carry out his agenda until these positions are filled.
Well, we're seeing living proof of that day by day, aren't we? That this between the leaks and the capers like the Iran certification that you mentioned, Fred Feitz, and just I think the failure to execute the president's policy, indeed countermanding the policy on the part of cabinet-level officials raises really the urgent need for the president to ensure that the people staffing his government, including, of course, in those cabinet positions, are part of his team. Fred, it's so good to talk with you, and I appreciate your time as always, as well as the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again next week. John Rossomondo joins us next. We'll talk with him about a number of things, including how the Islamists are inside the wire and what's to be done about that. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we're joined by John Rossomondo, one of the most perspicacious reporters on matters involving terrorism and counterterrorism these days, in his post as a senior counterterrorism analyst at the highly acclaimed Investigative Project on Terrorism. John has quite a history of investigative reporting and other activities in the journalistic trade, including as a web editor at the Washington Examiner, published as the Daily Caller. He also was the managing editor of the Philadelphia Bulletin. It's very good to catch up with him. He's doing great reporting these days at IPT. John, thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
Thanks, Frank, for having me.
Let me ask you about a couple of things that have sort of a common denominator, the Muslim Brotherhood. First, John, you've reported about the Council on American-Islamic Relations having gotten the school district of San Diego, California, to adopt lock, stock, and barrel, apparently uncritically, their so-called anti-Islamophobia training. Remind us who CARE is and why you would not want these people anywhere near counterterrorism or anti-Islamophobia, or your children, for that matter.
Well, Frank, the Council on American Islamic Relations was founded in 1994 as the result of a meeting a year earlier in 1993 of Hamas activists who were aiming to create a PR front. Its founder executive director, Nihad Awad, is an avowed supporter of Hamas. Co-founder, Omar Ahmad, likewise was a supporter of Hamas.
In fact, there's a rather considerable litany of people who were involved with terrorism, some of whom have gone to jail, who have been associated with this organization, including as members of the staff. We're talking with John Rossomondo of the Investigative Project on Terrorism, and these guys are clearly inside the wire of the Council on American Islamic Relations for the School District of San Diego. Is this an anomaly, or is this symptomatic of a bigger problem we have with their penetration?
Well, this is symptomatic of a bigger problem with their penetration. The lawyers who are for parents who are suing the school district over CARE's creation of a so-called anti-Islamophobia program that aims to ostensibly counter anti-Muslim bigotry, or not bigotry, I mean bullying, rather, is being seen as a test program that they want to spread across the country. And the parents are suing because they say that CARE is a religious organization and that they're trying to spread religious propaganda, which violates the First and 14th Amendments. If you had a Christian or a Jewish group having a similar partnership with a public school system, the left would be up in arms. I mean, they'd be like, they would be screaming, this violates the separation of church and state.
And John, I understand that the plaintiffs have just amended their complaint to make clear to the court this connection between CARE and an organization that, as you know, as you've done so much to document at IPT, has as its stated mission in the United States, quote, destroying Western civilization from within. This is it shouldn't be a hard call, should it?
I mean, it shouldn't. I mean, if you just look at the documents from CARE and some of its sister organizations in the American Brotherhood, they want to supplant Western civilization with Islamic civilization.
Hey, John, speaking of these organizations, there's another one that I wanted just to get your take on, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, also out in Southern California, Los Angeles-based. Tell us a little bit about its pedigree. Does it also have ties to Hamas? And what has DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, recently done about them?
Well, the Muslim Public Affairs Council was founded in the 1980s by a former member of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Its executive director, Salam al-Mariati, routinely tries to deny the connection between jihad and violence, despite the fact that the Brotherhood's founder, Hassan al-Banna, said that the notion that jihad was just a spiritual conflict within oneself or so forth was bunk, and that there was war, then all meant it meant violence. Mariotti.
That's a clue, I would say, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. Mariotti has a history of apologizing for Hamas and Al Qaeda fundraising operations, and most recently, they tried passing this idea along that President Trump wanted to round up Muslims and put them into internment camps, when the president and no one in the administration have said as much. Yet they had something with Star Trek actor Mr. Sulu, George Takei, saying it was going to happen.
John, let me switch gears, because there's so much more to talk about. I just want to hit one other thing. In addition to these Muslim Brotherhood front organizations that are now, being deprived, thank goodness, of, in this case at least, of MPAC, of government funding, which was headed their way, you actually have pedigreed Muslim brothers from Egypt being trotted into Congress. What on earth is going on here? They seem to be much in evidence on Capitol Hill at the moment, and they shouldn't be anywhere near there, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I mean, you have the Egyptian Americans for Freedom and Justice, which, if you look at accounts in the Egyptian press, is directly connected to the Brotherhood. Their president, Hani El-Khadi, admitted on Facebook in Arabic that he's a Brotherhood member. He even included a, an ISIS-style thing with, the guy on a horse and so forth. And they went and visited Congress at the beginning of May, and, had several Democratic members of Congress admitting them. And, they put out this idea that President Sisi is a monster. And they also want to gloss over the fact that they're connected with ISIS in the Sinai, and they're supporting, the guys who visited Capitol Hill openly support something called the Popular Resistance Movement and the Revolutionary Punishment Movement, which are terrorist organizations that have carried out attacks. I mean, they've even posted stuff on Facebook supporting these terrorist groups.
John, let me switch gears one more time. Again, our guest is John Rossomondo, the senior counterterrorism analyst at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. You've been writing about a group that has been a very malevolent force, it seems to me, a soulmate, or at least a certain an enabler of these Muslim Brotherhood operatives, namely the Southern Poverty Law Center. They've been picked up, their screeds of late, by an interesting outfit. Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, for several years, the Communist Party USA's online news paper, People's World, has been republishing their op-eds. I went and called Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, thinking, hey, if your things were being picked up by, like, a neo-Nazi group, you'd condemn it then and there. And I thought, hey, the Communist Party is running your thing. Do you want to condemn it? He wouldn't condemn it. And then I went and did some research about the group that's distributing their op-eds, and it's connected with a group called the Institute for Policy Studies, which was connected with the KGB and Cuban intelligence in the 1970s.
Sure, an old communist front during the Cold War. It was notorious in the extreme. John, there's so much more to talk about on that score alone, let alone the rest of these topics. I hope we can get you back on very soon. We are hard out of time for the moment today, but thank you again for joining us and for the great work you do. Next up, we will be speaking with Enrique Altimari, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we are joined by Enrique Altimari, a man I've just met for the first time yesterday and was extremely impressed by in the course of a presentation that he made with several others, also hailing from Venezuela, active in the pro-democracy movement there. Enrique is these days a graduate student at King's College in London, but has been a student leader in the fight against the Maduro regime, which has become increasingly despotic and repressive and really horrifically punishing of its people at every level, politically, economically, socially. And I was very taken with Enrique's insights, especially as a young man. He brings a great deal of wisdom to what's happening to his country and why it should matter to us, as well as, of course, his own people and the people of the region. Enrique Altimari, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Well, thank you. Let me ask you, in a way, if you could sort of paint the picture of what is happening in Venezuela, and in the process, maybe give us a little bit of your flavor of some of the developments that are in the news at the moment. This helicopter delivered attack, such as it was, against the Supreme Court. The chief prosecutor, an appointee of the Maduro government, who seems now to be in some legal difficulty herself at the hands of that government, and this whole effort to bring about a constituent assembly to sort of supplant the regular order there. Tell us about the story of which these are important elements at the moment.
Yeah, well, first of all, the country has been on fire, in the flames in one way or another, because it has been with huge demonstrations across the whole country for more than 85 days now. We're talking about 80 to 85% of the country don't want Nicolas Maduro as a president. They want Nicolas Maduro to leave, to step out of office this year, and they want general elections. The government of Maduro, on the other hand, don't want to do any kind of election that allows democratic avenue to have some sort of alternability. Instead, what they are doing is trying to put as much pressure as they can on the opposition and on the population to perpetuate in government. The role of the military in this scenario is incredibly important. The Nicolas Maduro regime is not sustained on popularity or not even on votes. They are surviving through the might of the guns, through the might of the corruption schemes and scandals, and through the terror, like by terrorizing the population. So we've had more than 83 people killed during these 85 days of protests, is roughly one a day. And then you have things like what happened yesterday with a helicopter on top of the Supreme Court, or Luis Ortega Diaz's situation.
Let me ask you about the attack on the Supreme Court. There's a report that some police officer commandeered a helicopter and threw some grenades at the Supreme Court. This does not sound like a very serious attack. In your judgment, Enrique, and that of your colleagues, does it seem as though this is simply a provocation engineered by the regime?
Yes, I mean, it seems, at least I am aware, or I know for a fact, that the opposition did implant this. It was not involved in any kind of way. And what is left for me to say is that this is probably just a distraction kind of scheme by the government to move forward in other ways. Like, for example, by militarizing our parliament, our National Assembly. It was militarized just 2 days ago. Or by putting pressure on the general prosecution, the chief prosecutor, as you said, Luis Ortega Diaz, and taking away all the powers that are conferred to her office by the Constitution.
Let's take those in turn. This Constituent Assembly, when you talk about militarizing the Parliament, the National Assembly, I think you mean by that essentially they're putting it out of business, right? And that there's going to be some new mechanism that will essentially rule by fiat. Is that how this will work if they have their way in the Maduro regime?
I mean, yeah, the Maduro regime has progressively been taking away all the constitutional powers of the National Assembly from day one, basically. These guys, they don't know how to work in a democracy. They don't know how to tolerate powers being from other parties. So they just do what they know, which is seizing all the power. And in that sense, the Supreme Court has been incredibly important for this by ruling over 50 different decisions, taking away the powers. What I talked about, the militarization, is that literally the military took the building of the National Assembly,
occupying it.
Boxes there. People don't know what they are. Yeah, they occupied it. But then, of course, your question about the National Constituent Assembly is incredibly important. Maduro's regime, they are moving forward with their communist plan. And the next step, the next very important step, is to radically change the constitution, which is already a very flawed constitution that was passed by Chavez in 1999. And basically what they want to do is to pass a new constitution without a referendum to approve it, without a referendum to actually go to a process to change it.
And that's presumably because they are so overwhelmingly unpopular. I think you mentioned yesterday that 85% of the public is hostile to the regime and what it's doing. They could never win a vote, even one that's stacked as they typically do. And just very quickly, Enrique, tell us about this chief prosecutor. She was an instrument of the regime, as I understand it, but then fell from grace. Why?
Yeah, I mean, she put Leopoldo López in jail, for example. She was very, very, very evil, very bad during the 2014. But it seems like this year it was just the tipping point, as you might say. Like, it was a turning point for her in the sense that it is too much, yes.
And Leopoldo, of course, was one of the leaders of the opposition that she imprisoned. She may wind up there herself now, it sounds as though, if the government has its way. Do you see it coming to that?
To what? Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Do you see it coming to that she may be herself imprisoned by the regime?
Yes, I think that, I mean, I definitely see that the government, I mean, it already happened. They took away the powers conferred by the Constitution to be chief prosecutor. I think that it is possible that she will be imprisoned in the future, but what it is certain today is that she lost the constitutional powers.
Let me ask you in closing, Enrique, and this has been extremely troubling, but very informative. What would your advice be to the United States at this time? How can we help, and why is it so important that we do so?
Well, it is important because otherwise the people of Venezuela is not able by themselves to solve the situation. These guys are too bad. They have the Russians, the Chinese, and the Cubans with them. They have all the guns in the country and all the money in the country, and they completely seized all the powers of the state. How to help? I think that the United States position has to be firm. The United States has to be resolute. And that means that it is not only about the OAS, for example, or not only about diplomatic kind of interchanges, but directly about sanctions to people involved in corruption schemes by the government or to people that are just violating basic human rights.
Would you go so far as to recommend that we stop perhaps purchasing oil from Venezuela or at the very least stop supplying gasoline that powers the tanks and other weapons of the regime?
I would, especially after the 30th of July, which is the day of the National Constituent Assembly. I think that the United States government, if that happens, needs to be very, very resolute and firm in August. And that means going to the throat, going to hit hard the Venezuelan government.
To try to help free the people. Enrique Altamare, this is a subject to which I know we will be returning often. I'm very pleased to make your acquaintance both personally yesterday and now with my audience by phone. I appreciate extraordinarily your courage and your clarity on the stakes for your country, as well as I said, for the rest of us. And I know that you'll keep up your good work. I hope you'll come back to us again in the very near future.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we are joined for the first time by a woman I've only just met by phone in the past day or so. Her name is Heather Sirocki. She is a state representative in the House legislature in the state of Maine. She represents the people of the 28th District, a part of Maine called Scarborough, and she serves on the Appropriations and Financial Affairs Committee, and she is at the moment very much the woman in the center of the arena. She is working hard to secure the passage of legislation to have Maine join 24 other states that prohibit female genital mutilation in their territory. She is facing a bit of a fight at the moment, and I'm very pleased to have her with us to talk a little bit about how she got into this fight, why it's so important, and what the prospects are for Maine once again leading the nation. Representative Sirocki, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about the work at hand. I know you're a busy woman at the moment. I appreciate you taking the time.
Frank, thank you so much for having me on your program. I started on this trying to work on this legislation because a constituent contacted me and asked me to submit this legislation. And I said if I was to receive the honor of being reelected, I would do so. And at first, I thought this can't possibly be happening in Maine, and that it was more of a perfunctory kind of thing just to join 24 other states and have the prohibition in place. And then I discovered I was wrong. And I discovered quite a few things. One, I didn't realize that you really need to have state laws for state prosecutors and federal laws for federal prosecutors. So while the mutilation of female genitals is illegal at the federal level, it is up to each state to codify that into their own state law so that their state prosecutors could prosecute this as a crime. The federal prosecutors take on very few cases, and state prosecutors take on thousands of cases. So it is more likely, if this crime was to occur, that it would need to have a state law in order to prosecute the crime. And my bill does two things. One, it differentiates between the person doing the cutting and the person that may have coordinated with the cutter, usually a parent. And my bill is limited to under 18-year-olds.
Is there reason to believe, Representative Sirocki, that this is in fact happening in the state of Maine, or at least that children in residence there are being subjected to this barbaric mutilation?
Well, when people think of Maine, they may not think that we have a large population of immigrants that might be bringing this cultural tradition with them from their homeland. But in fact, Maine was identified as one of the 8 high-risk areas in the country. And as such, we have received a federal grant that was awarded last summer. There's a group out of Portland, Maine, which is in southern Maine, that was awarded the grant. They are focusing on both Portland and Lewiston, which are two areas in the state that have a large immigrant population. And the function of the grant was to outreach into communities, educate, train providers, in a culturally sensitive way, specifically focusing on female genital mutilation. Now, that's a term I did not make up. The World Health Organization, UNICEF, Equality Now, many different organizations refer to Centers for Disease Control. They some call it female genital cutting, some call it female genital mutilation, or some call it, in the Muslim community, they have a word for it, and they call it circumcision. It is not circumcision. This is the removal of part or all of female genitalia.
It's more like castration, it seems to me, if you're going to make the comparison to the male physiology.
Pretty barbaric. And there are, I have anecdotal stories that I could share with you that happened here in Maine. Unfortunately, this is not being reported. This is very much underground. It is illegal at the federal level. So it's unusual that someone would come out and say, hey, I just performed female genital mutilation, or I just treated it. So they're not, providers seem to be being extra culturally sensitive and not reporting this crime to the CDC. As mandated reporters, nurses, doctors, medical providers need to report this is child abuse.
Because it is so horrific, because it is patently inhumane, particularly to children, who is actually supporting this practice in the state legislature of Maine as we speak? This is coming to a vote, I understand, perhaps this very day. What kind of opposition could you possibly be getting?
Well, there are a number of ways that people push back on this. The ACLU has come out in other states and in the state of Maine saying that we do not need to expand our criminal code to specifically specify female genital mutilation, that you can already prosecute this under existing state law. And in fact, we have a different but somewhat similar case that says that is not so, that we do need specific state law in order to make it clear to the prosecutors. And the Maine Prosecutors Association came out strongly in favor of this bill, saying they need this law. They feel they need this law in order to prosecute this crime. But some people still feel that current Maine law is sufficient enough and that we don't need to expand it. I would counter that by saying that the Maine legislature recently voted on to expand and clarify our distracted driving law. We have a distracted driving law here in the state of Maine, and we have a specific law that says you may not text. Well, that is driving distracted, and now we have clarified that specifically. So we do expand upon and clarify our laws all the time.
You've gone back and forth. The Senate has approved this legislation, as I understand it, unanimously. The House very narrowly defeated an earlier version of it. I guess I'd ask you to make book for us. Where do things stand now? And if there are people listening to this program who are able to, before the deed is done, how can they help you try to protect these children in the state of Maine?
Unfortunately, the pushback now has become a party line. For the most part, I have, I think, one Democrat that's willing to come along with us, which is funny because in many other states, this is actually a bill that's promoted by Democrats.
Well, at the very least, it's fully bipartisan.
Exactly. It is just kind of funny that it's divided on party lines here. Some of the Democrats feel that so if you're going to target anyone, you target the House Democrats in the state of Maine. They feel that me, the sponsor of the bill, has presented the bill out of hate. And I would say to them, they're absolutely right. I hate child abuse. And that's what this is. This is not an anti-Muslim bill, because there are some Christian communities that engage in this also. So this does, there is evidence that it's happening and spreading into other segments of our population. We need to send a clear message now. No, we do not do this here in America.
We certainly don't want it done in Maine at the moment, that's for sure, or as you say, anyplace else. And my hope is that with your leadership, Representative Heather Sirocki, you will see the state of the Maine once again leading the nation and ensuring that the remaining 25 other states join you in prohibiting this horrible, horrible crime, female genital mutilation. We have to leave it at that for the moment. We look forward to talking with you after the dust has settled and on all this. Good luck, and I do hope that all of our listeners will weigh in to support you and ensure that those of your colleagues in the House on both sides of the aisle do the same. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again next week, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.